Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is October 10th, 2013. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm talking to you from Boulder, Colorado. I'm out for the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. We're going to be streaming live from the conference, and we put the stream up on our blog so you can access it there. We're going to have a great lunch with subscribers on Saturday, October 12th in Boulder. So if you're in the environment, we hope to see you there. I just saw great subscribers at the conference in Tucson last weekend. And I have to tell you, you're about the most wonderful group of people. Very smart, very savvy, very positive. You know, you bump into the tapeworm and you get up and keep on going. And I have to tell you, it's a real privilege to know you and to be of service to you. Also, a subscriber luncheon in San Francisco coming up on October 29th. Our theme tonight is Leave the Complexity Behind. I had Justin put up in our slides this evening a slide that I used from my speech last week. I'm going to use it in the speech this week, and it's called The Financial Coup d'Etat Before and After. And I just kind of picked numbers out of the air to help you understand the concept. In the before picture, we see the legacy systems before the financial coup d'etat and after the financial coup d'etat. Before the financial coup d'etat, they had 100 trillion in assets and 100 trillion of liabilities. After the coup d'etat, they have 60 trillion of assets and 100 trillion of liabilities. If you look on the after, you have the breakaway civilization before and after. After the financial coup d'etat, the breakaway civilization now has the 40 trillion in assets. Oftentimes, what I hear as I listen to various commentators and go to conferences is folks saying, oh, we have 100 trillion of liabilities, we have 60 trillion of assets, we're going to have trouble with the debt, we're going to have trouble on the Social Security, on the retirement benefits, everything's terrible, the system's going to collapse. Wait a minute. That $40 trillion went someplace, and the entities that it in now have $40 trillion of assets with no liabilities, and they're reinvesting. And in fact, one of the reasons the coup d'etat occurred was they wanted to reinvest that money in new technology and space and infrastructure and manufacturing base as opposed to pay for people's nursing homes. Now, that's not a pretty picture. I'm not saying I like that picture. What I am saying is that's reality. So before you assume that the economy is simply 60 trillion of assets and 100 trillion of liabilities and everything's going to collapse, you need to look at the picture of there's 40 trillion being reinvested, and the breakaway civilization is going gangbusters. It's the legacy systems that are fading away. So I say that because one of the great defenses, there are two great defenses that the legacy systems will use to now reconcile the 60 trillion of assets to the 100 trillion of liabilities. One is called projective identification, and that's where you accuse the victims of what you, in fact, are doing. So get ready for lots of investigations and accusations against fraud, a fraud against all sorts of, you know, small companies and little people, and we're all getting more and more parking tickets and fines and everything else. So, you know, the people who are now showing up to collect their 100 trillion in liabilities are suddenly going to be attacked for doing the very thing that the leadership did, which was steal all the money. But the second thing that I want to talk about tonight is complexity. Rather than say, no, you can't have health care because we don't want to pay for it, you say, oh, well, we're giving you insurance, but you have to pay for it, and it's much more complicated, and you have to do this, and then you have to do that, and you have to pay this money, and then you'll get thrown off, and you have to go around in circles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And before you know it, you show up, in fact, to exercise your need for healthcare because you have insurance, and oh, well, that's not covered, and this requires more here, and to get that, you have to go to a different hospital over there. And before you know it, in addition to not getting healthcare, you've spent hundreds of hours trying to exercise your promises. And that's simply a way of saying no without having to say, well, no. And the danger is, if they'd said no, you wouldn't have lost hundreds of hours of your time. So this complexity is rolling down. We're seeing it roll down in the healthcare area, but it's happening all across society. And if there's anything I want to do on the Solari Report, it's protect you from that complexity. So remember that complexity is necessary to obfuscate. I'll tell you how I first saw this. I got quite a lesson working at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We had a program at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, multifamily insurance. And at the time, we were originating $5 billion a year of multifamily insurance. And the question was, if you were issuing federal credit to insure mortgages for apartment buildings, and in fact, you were charging less than market rates, then the question was, how could you equate supply and demand? Because if you're charging less than the market would charge, which we were, significantly less, then let's say if at a market price, you'd have $5 billion of demand for $5 billion of supply. But at a price that's significantly below market, it's government subsidized, you're going to get $25 billion of demand for $5 billion of mortgage insurance. And what would happen is you'd have $25 billion of demand come into HUD, and then it got caught up in what I called the 26-step process. They made it very complex, and the bureaucracy made it very difficult to get approved. And what, of course, happened was you had different attorneys in Washington who were knowledgeable about HUD and knowledgeable about multifamily insurance, and they would be hired by the right people, and they would get inside, and they would walk the applications through. And the applications that would make it through the process were the ones who were politically favored. So think of it this way. You can have an allocation process that allocates on price, or you can have clear political criteria. The politicians can get together and say, we want affordable housing in these places, and so ones that are pink get it, and ones that are blue not, and you can allocate it according to clear criteria. The problem is, with clear criteria, there was no way they could give clear criteria for what they really wanted, which is, we want the major donors to get the $5 billion of credit. So you have a covert agenda. And how do you reconcile that? You put everybody into the 26-step process where they gridlock, and then you allocate the $5 billion by political means that happen in a covert and sort of secret manner. And gridlock, complexity, entanglement is your cover story. It gives you the ability to deny that you're really doing what you're doing. And that's what we're going to see in all these different areas, including healthcare, which is you make the thing unbelievably complicated, and that's how you reconcile the $5 billion of demand. I'm sorry, the $5 billion of supply with $25 billion of demand. Okay, now, what happens to us if we're not one of the insiders who gets the $5 billion? We have our time wasted going back and forth in the 26-step process. The way I really saw it, I did a design sprint several weeks ago on a weekend I was at Open Source Ecology in Missouri. The blog post is up on the blog, where I participated in design sprint to build a micro house. And it was very interesting documenting the steps that Chris Reinhart, the project manager, was using to build the utility wall for the house. And as I documented, I realized, you know, I could do this. I could learn how to build a micro house. And what I realized participating in the design sprint and sort of the process of doing open source hardware is the complexity of home building, the complexity of the mortgage system, and more importantly, the corruption in it, which makes it much more complex and risky to engage in, has reached the point where, frankly, it's just simpler to get together with a group of friends and learn how to do it all yourself. And if you learn how to do it yourself, then you don't need to borrow money to finance it. You know, you bring the cost down so much. So now a lot of people are going to say what I'm thinking in the back of my mind, which is, I don't want to build my own house. That's a lot of work. You know, learning how to build your own house means you can oversee the contractor. So given how much fun it is to do these things, what I would really say is, if you have young people in your family, if you have children, if you have grandchildren, or if you have the time, learning how to do these things for ourselves has become easier than going into a system where complexity is being used as a way of obfuscating corruption and all sorts of things going on. So When you think about freedom from complexity, the more we can learn how to do things for ourselves and get out of that system, the better. Money and markets. The big story, of course, this week is the government shutdown over the budget. As I've said many times, I'm going to keep repeating it. The reconciling the $60 trillion of assets to $100 trillion of liabilities is a process that's going to take years. It's going to go on and on. If you want to understand all the challenges of that reconciliation, please go read my article, Coming Clean, Over the Fiscal Cliff, because I really felt it was so important that we had a detailed, sort of deep understanding and explanation of why this thing is just going to go on for years. So please don't get upset about this one. It's only the beginning. Indications today, the White House has endorsed a short-term debt limit increase with no policy conditions so that they can push out the borrowing authority out to November 22nd. And, you know, I think the chances of there being a default on government debt over these reasons are absolutely zero. There's no reason a president of the United States would ever risk a default for such a reason. The Republicans have, you know, one thing it's important to understand is that oftentimes laws are authorized and then money's not appropriated for it. So the House has authorized appropriations for all spending other than Obamacare. The president has simply said he's not going to accept those appropriations without getting one for Obamacare. I suspect that many Americans don't begin to understand how harmful Obamacare is going to be. It's the ultimate in 26-step processes again and again and again. So it's not just our money, it's our time. But and that's why the administration gave businesses a one-year relief. When they did that, they invited major political trouble because they're turning to the what has traditionally been a Republican constituency and said the Republicans can't help you, but we can, and leaving the Republicans looking very weak in front of not only the small business, but the individuals who are not getting a get-out-of-jail-free card. So very surprising political move. I suspect the administration had no choice given the problems they had with implementation. The president announced Janet Yellen as the Fed chief. I suspect that the sort of current mess and the concerns it was causing in the market really put Yellen over the top. I put up a blog post yesterday when Yellen was announced. Let me just read it to you because I think this is a very good outcome given what could have happened. I said, Janet Yellen has been announced as the new Federal Reserve Chairman. That's good news. She was the best candidate on the president's list. First of all, she is an adult. She has also experience within the Fed's bureaucracy, which matters given the constraints under which the chairman must operate. Finally, she is aware that humans exist and that they matter in a healthy economy. While financial fraud could make it possible and convenient for prior Fed chairmen to be indifferent to the right side of the balance sheet, the next appointee will be well served to be concerned with reality. I got a question from subscriber Catherine. Isn't this a figurehead position controlled by the banking cartel at all? Knowing the goals of the bank, are you suggesting that Yellen will just be nice along the way? What is the glimmer of hope you have? I, in one sense, I agree completely with a subscriber who asked that question. The Fed chairman at this point is very much constrained by many different conditions related to what the private bankers are going to do, require, operate. Remember, the Fed's operational capacity in many respects is limited, and the system is very much set up the way it is. At the same time, if you look at the choices and the major competitors to what to Yellen, we had people who I wouldn't describe as adults. I don't think that they are emotionally mature. I don't think they're interested in doing a good job. They have much more of a covert agenda. I think they have much bigger control files. And even though essentially at this point the Federal Reserve is what I would describe as the legacy systems, and even though you know, I would no more do or want that job than the man in the moon, we are always better off for having qualified people who are both ethical and competent. Someone asked me if I didn't feel badly. I had been invited to be a governor of the Federal Reserve and turned it down after I left the Bush administration. Somebody asked me, well, don't you kind of feel sad that it's Yellen and not you? And I said, absolutely not. Everybody has a purpose, and my purpose is in the world that's growing and not the one that's fading away. And if you look at what I believe is ultimately really going on inside the Federal Reserve, I just feel that morally it's not something I want anything to do with. So some of us are entrepreneurs and some of us are, you know, sort of financial staff at the highest levels. And I am deeply appreciative of that somebody of Yellen's quality would be willing to do that job. Lord knows I would not. The financial markets continue to pretty much go sideways. The stock market's been a little bit off. There are many reasons to expect correction in the North American markets, but it'll be interesting to see how they respond when the markets, when the debt decision finally gets made. We've seen precious metals trading off. We have yet to find a bottom on precious metals. And my concern is until we find that bottom, we don't know if we're back in a primary or we're still in a primary trend. I've said the primary trend needs to reassert between now and March. And I believe that's the case. There are others who believe it could take longer. I'm not sure I have the patience beyond March. So let's see what happens. But precious metals is acting weak. And it broke this morning, the 1300 line. So let's see how it does for the rest of the week. I'm going to be with Franklin Sanders next month. We'll be talking about precious metals. But I'll be watching it very carefully and report to you. Interest rates holding their own. The dollar strong despite what's happening, I think. So let's see what happens after the shutdown. Or stronger than one would expect. Two articles I wanted to point out in the blog. One is Airbnb is really leading the way in terms of helping people start to look at places and the value of places because it ties to the rent that they can get. And I think it's a very interesting little piece. It's up on the blog. Airbnb's chief map maker charts the world's neighborhoods. And we're going to, it's all part of the planetary debt for equity stop swap. We're really going to start to see a tight correlation between the sort of how wonderful a place is for humans and life and the value of the real estate in that place. Another quick commentary up this week. Tesla is now number one. The new Tesla S model is now number one in Norway with a market share of 5.1%, which just shows you how wonderful life can be in a country that has a sovereign wealth fund and doesn't drain and pump and dump the population. So don't you wish you lived in Norway? It is a bit cold. Anyway, Ask Catherine, we have an unbelievable, oh, first let me do a hero. Our hero this week of Fukushima workers who were sprayed by contaminated water as they continue to try and contain what's happening at Fukushima. There was great talk at the Casey conference, very wide divergence of opinion. But I would say that I felt the strongest reports were real concern, of course, that the ocean water continues to cycle to keep the unit that has not been contained sort of under control. With the bigger problem being the stored and new fuel rods up on top. And the question, of course, is if there's another earthquake or tsunami, what in the world could happen? We could be looking at something very dire. Our other hero, we have a co-hero this week, is Derek Zulick, who is the owner of Days Inn in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm now speaking to you from. The Global Breakthrough Energy Conference was scheduled to be at the University of Colorado. At the last minute, they got cold feet, and out we went, and Days Inn has welcomed us with open arms, and I must say, I think it's a far more intellectually and emotionally free place to have the conference. So I couldn't be more delighted, but he's done an extraordinary thing to bring us over, and I want to thank him. It's a perfect example. Entrepreneurs will save the world. Ask Catherine, a lot of questions tonight. If Mr. Global is going to transfer capital from bonds into the stock market, would it not make sense from their point of view to crash the stock market first so they can buy in cheap and diminish everyone else in the process, presumably gaining more control? Absolutely. What do you think 2008 and 2009 was? They already did it. Could they do it again? Yeah, it's possible. But I think if you look at what they did during the 2008 to 2010 period, both real estate and equities, they were able to scarf up an awful lot. You mentioned when you were in the depths of litigation that you studied people who had survived and not what made them successful or unsuccessful. Would you be willing to put up a list of resources? I feel in the coming years it may get ugly and many others may benefit by being aware of this. That is a great idea. That is absolutely a great idea. I have covered pieces of that in past reports, but I think it would be a great idea to sort of pull things together. And maybe if we could help build them, I know a lot of other people have great, sort of great resources. I've done several blog posts on resources or sort of lessons learned from other economies when they collapsed, and they were helpful as well. But I thank you for that suggestion, and we will follow up on it. Why is the story about the woman with a child who runs through barricades in D.C. under the geopolitical section? What's going on there? I put the story up because I think I put it in geopolitical because I think of all the places that it belongs, that's the appropriate one. I don't think we know what the real story, and that is another one of those situations, just like the shooting at the Naval Yard, where you could spend hundreds of hours trying to figure out, and you'd never manage to do it. But something's very strange. And I can conjecture is about 100 different explanations. I don't know what it is, but it's another warning that things are not right in River City. You mentioned that you haven't had a television for many years now, but you enjoy watching movies. With this in mind, how do you watch your movies? I watch my movies a couple ways. One is occasionally I'll watch online through Netflix. I have a little DVD player, the smallest you can get, that I play when I'm in the jacuzzi. And then I have an old television that's not hooked up to cable. It can't receive TV, but I'll use it. And it's rather, relative to the big flat screen TVs, it's relatively small. I find a lot of those technologies can literally be too overwhelming. So I tend to watch it on uglier small screens and then let the art carry itself. Next question. Just a follow-up to the new economy that you foresee in our future. I pray you're correct, as it sounds like the best plausible outcome to an otherwise tenuous situation. Two things that I can't quite square at the moment. The effect of the strategy on decades of dumbing down the population, starting with the schools, and the major deterioration of the U.S. infrastructure, including the technological infrastructure. I think that's all part of the reengineering. There's no point in reinvesting in the infrastructure if you're going to change it. I also think that if you look at what it's going to take to run the new infrastructure or new industrial sort of capacity, they don't need most of the population, and that explains the dumbing down. If you look at what they're up to in schools with the testing, the idea is to call out the kids who can become robotics engineers early on and shoot them on the right pathway. So all of that makes sense to me when you realize that the labor they need is very sophisticated and it's a much smaller group of people. A couple more questions in this venue, which I'll take up later when we get into much more detail about what I think that infrastructure and technology looks like. On a different note, I'm thinking about getting my nephew a 3D printer for Christmas. He's in a physics program, and I thought just having one might encourage him to experiment and become comfortable. I'd appreciate any comments. Make Magazine every year did last year a list of 3D printers to give as Christmas presents and their sort of recommendations. And I would go to Make Magazine and find their latest list. It's the best one I've seen. We got a great mailing from a subscriber in Switzerland that I wanted to read to you. Dear Catherine, being a Swiss citizen, I wanted to explain just a bit. He was writing about the referendum on the Swiss citizens that I put up last week. Today's citizens of Switzerland get $2,800 per month from the state under certain conditions, e.g. if you're over 65 or if you're disabled. And you get money when you lost your job. It's always under certain conditions. A student with poor parents might get money from the state too. The new proposal is you get $2,800 unconditional. It focuses more on unconditional than on $2,800. The actual amount will be defined as part of a political process. The question is conditional or unconditional. Today, if you're disabled and you find a small job that you can do, tough luck, you lose your disability payment. So as a disabled person, you better not try to be of any use to society. And today, financing Social Security in Switzerland is in difficulty, to say it mildly. Thus, a new concept like this basic income would fix a whole lot of other issues all at once. And maybe not an important deal. $2,800 per month is not enough to live in Switzerland. Costs are so high that most people would have to work anyway, except their salary will be reduced by $2,800. There is a socialist component in this proposal. A minimum wage worker today with, say, 3,000 francs salary could consider working at a previous job for only 500 francs difference. He or she would ask for more money. In the end, a low-income person might get 4,000 francs, 1,000 more than previously. Of course, the majority of people will turn this proposal down when it will come to a vote in a few years. But in the meantime, we have lots of discussions in the media about the current system and about the proposed system. This is, in my opinion, the only reason to call for a vote, to have discussions about this issue. It's a great comment. I couldn't agree more. In a way, to put something on the agenda that otherwise wouldn't be a discussion point. That's how things work in the Swiss democracy. That's absolutely right. It's one of the reasons I so love. If you ever really want to see democracy at work, go learn how the Swiss do it. It's quite remarkable. Some politicians suggest that people should work not only till they reach 65, but till 67. And young people, when they graduate, they don't find jobs. And if old people lose their job at the age of 50 or 60, they cannot find a job anymore. It doesn't make sense if old people hang on to their jobs and graduated young people end up unemployed and jobless, get food stamps worth $2,800. Why not pay $2,800 unconditional and no food stamps? At least they can all eat. Then the lucky ones that find a job will earn more and will be able to spend more. And one other funny thing in Swiss is this. A separate proposal to limit monthly executive pay to no more than the company's lowest paid staff earn in a year, the so-called 1-to-12 initiative, faces a popular vote on November 24th. Managers complain that their salary would have to be reduced. Nobody suggests to increase the salary of the low-wage jobs to 1/12 of the high-paid manager salary. Of course not. And while it is on the radar of the media now up to November 24, salaries of top bankers and managers are discussed, sometimes even reduced, and are an issue for Joe the plumber. And in the few years, we have a law for 115 or 120. Unconditional basic income for every Swiss adult is a way to free money from central banks for the poor people. I'm looking forward to your comments on Thursday night. Very astute comments. I agree. We have unconditional free money from central banks for the rich people. It would be nice to balance the equation. Anyway, more questions, which I'll defer to next week. Again, great questions and thank you. I think the comment from our Swiss subscriber shows the kind of debates that are going to be going on as we go through this explosion in technology. This is going to be a conversation that's going on for a long, long time. So get ready. It's all part of the budget explosion and re-engineering conversation as well. Our interview this week is up on the blog. It's a wonderful discussion of 3D printing as an example of the kind of explosion we're seeing in new fabrication technology. I think what's happening in fabrication technology is very important, particularly the speed at which we can translate bits to atoms and back to bits again. That's really what this is about. And the process of taking things from information and into hardware or from software to hardware and back to software is speeding up dramatically. And I think this is only the beginning. So I hope you enjoy that interview. It's going to be one that we're going to be having lots more on innovation and new technology as it unfolds. Our movie in Let's Go to the Movies was to dovetail with the interview. I think 3D printing is a much easier to see when you, or to understand when you see it operate visually. And PBS had a very nice 8-minute short on 3D printing, so we put it up as the Let's Go to the Movies this week. So enjoy it. It's quick and snappy. In closing, next week, John Rapoport has agreed to take his spot next week because we're going to be doing the equity overview with Chuck Gibson on the emerging markets on October 24th. And then for Halloween, I'm finally going to do it. The report on what is the zombie phenomena all about, really. So until next week with John Rapoport, I'll be doing a money in markets. Dovetailing with that. So until next week with John Rapoport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.